Okay. Was that a fruitful discussion?
Yeah.
I meant during the break. Okay, we're still on God's story of redemption. We're not through the Old Testament yet. You got your notes?
Yep.
Some of you brought them, but if you didn't, I think they gave them to you if you don't have them. We ended, last time we were together, we ended at Haggai. Haggai, yeah, we're starting with Zechariah. Yeah? Nice glasses. Now, you remember the format. We're looking at the scripture. This is called biblical theology or redemption history. We're looking at it in four acts. And first act was creation, first two chapters. And then the second act is the fall, and that's nine chapters. Redemption is 1,175 chapters. And each one of the acts have various number of scenes, like a play would. Remember, in Act 3, there are nine scenes. We're in seven right now. Remember, it was patriarchs, number one, Exodus, the law, conquest, monarchy, the exile. Now we're in the return. And then in the New Testament, there's two scenes, number eight and nine, the Messiah and the church. So we're at Zechariah, and we're looking at Zechariah in redemption history. Zechariah was one of the three post-exilic prophets and a younger contemporary of Haggai. He was a prophet and a priest like Jeremiah and Ezekiel, and is often called the prophet of hope and encouragement in troubled times. His name actually means Yahweh remembers. Yahweh remembers, which is an appropriate term for people who feel they're forgotten. Even his name has theological significance. Zechariah probably began his ministry, or we know he began his ministry 2 months after Haggai, because it's dated, but continued his ministry much longer. So he's a younger contemporary. Haggai was probably a much older man who gave his prophecies and then pretty much died. Zechariah, a much younger man, and continued on. Number two, the figurative and apocalyptic style of Zechariah, along with the complexity of his vision, make this book one of the most difficult to understand in the entire Bible. Does anyone know if we've ever tried to tackle the book of Zechariah? I wouldn't imagine we have. Yeah. Well, in my research, I found that it has baffled some of the most astute commentators in history. So probably not something we want to tackle, huh? Zechariah, we do know, and maybe the part that we have looked at is it's filled with messianic prophecies. Messianic prophecies. Maybe we've examined those, though. And there they are listed for you. That's at least four of them, right? Role in redemption history. Zechariah was born in Babylon and was among those who returned to Palestine under the leadership of Zerubbabel and Joshua. Do you remember that there were three deportations. The first one, anybody remember? 605, yeah. And what main person went in that deportation? Daniel, yeah. So we just should just you and I talk? The second deportation was 797, and what major prophet went at that point? Ezekiel, yeah. 597. Yeah, did I say seven?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry, 597, yeah. 605, 597, and then 586. So three deportations and then three returns. Three returns. The first one is under Zerubbabel and Joshua, and that's when Zechariah came back. Historical conditions, circumstances and conditions under Zechariah, he ministered under, were in general those of Haggai's time. So we've already covered that. Intercanonical themes. The primary one is the kingdom. The dominant emphasis of the book is encouragement for God's people because of the glorious future he's promised them. And that's all I'm going to say about Zechariah. Really complex book. So I was just too exhausted to try to figure out much more than that. But I do have more to say about Ezra and Nehemiah, so let's go there. And we have done that before, haven't we? Especially Nehemiah, imagine, huh? Have you ever focused on Ezra? Yeah. Nehemiah, you know, that's probably some kind of leadership series, right? Yeah. The books now called Ezra and Nehemiah were originally known in the single title of Ezra. These books record the return of the Jewish exiles from Babylon and the rebuilding of the temple and the walls around Jerusalem. The Septuagint, you know, that's about 2nd or 3rd century B.C., treats this as just one book. And as far as we know, Origen is the first Christian author to divide the two. You know, we're talking about late 2nd, early 3rd century. And he called them 1st Ezra and 2nd Ezra. But he recognized that in the Hebrew they were originally one. And so eventually over time they took on the separate names centered around the main characters in their books. But originally, when it was written originally, it's one book. So when we think about Ezra and Nehemiah, we have to think about it as one. Like Kings or Chronicles or Samuel, right? Not as separate works. These are single works. The reason why Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles were divided is because they were too big to fit on a scroll. So they had to break them up into two. Ezra and Nehemiah for various different reasons. But we think about them as one, and we're going to talk about them as one. The highlights, really, in the books, it's about the temple and the personal attempts to keep the community pure from the influences of their neighbors. And maybe a great way to examine or to study this is how do God's people engage the world without becoming part of the world? That's a continual issue throughout Scripture and really throughout the history of the church. And I'm sure it's a continual issue in your pastoral ministry. How do we emphasize world engagement? Because when we do, that means people have to actually go out in the world. Secular friends, right? They have to participate. They have to expand their influence beyond just the borders of the church. And the problem is when church people go outside, the world is actively involved in evangelizing them. So we have this continual challenge. If they engage the world, they tend to become a part of the world. But if we separate from the world, then we have no influence in the world. Those are the two tendencies, and we could call them tribalism or assimilation. Assimilation is when you just become so much like the world you can't really tell the difference. Tribalism is when you distance yourself from the world so much you don't have any effect upon them. And I imagine in the pastoral ministry, there's continually keeping that balance. How do we engage the world and yet not become the world? It's interesting when you look at the history of Christian music. You know, when it first started, and, you know, I was saved in 1976 and just some of the early days, you know, with Acts, what was the second chapter of Acts, and Larry Norman. Any of you remember any of these? Nobody, huh? 1976. Nobody goes back that far, do they?
I heard the second chapter.
Yeah. Yeah, they go back late 60s, early 70s. These are all just Christian market, right? All Christian songs. And then the first few tried to start to cross over, right? Actually, U2 started as a Christian band. The Maranatha pastor, Kyle Holland, who went to Ireland, one of his church members was actually Bono's sister and told him all sorts of stories about Bono's early conversion and passion for the gospel. And, you know, they tried to cross over. Now they're completely known as a secular band. And you know, some people think there's some Christian stuff in there, and maybe, you know, but they probably wouldn't make it as solid Victory members, you know. Yeah. Yes.
One of the guys I went to, I was the last batch of MLI.
Yeah.
With what's his name? Greg Pittman. One of the guys, our pastor, an Irish guy, Fergus O'Regan. Wow. Classmate.
Yeah, Fergus O'Regan.
Fergus O'Regan.
Wow.
We got married, we met there. But Fergus O'Regan was the science teacher of Fauna.
Wow, really?
He was a science teacher, and he left. He became a pastor. But Bono and his younger sister were classmates. Mm. So the guy would come, we lived almost every day within the house.
Yeah.
He was always, yeah.
A lot of those groups, and then just, you know, you look at the history of Christian music, the ones who tried to cross over, a lot of times,
they fell over.
Yeah, yeah. Now, there are some examples that didn't. My friends, you know the band Skillet? They popular here, I don't know, they're Skillet. They're pretty much known. I mean, they tour and they travel as with secular bands, you know. But I know them personally, and they're godly, strong believers. And all their lyrics, I mean, they're like metal, heavy metal. But all their lyrics, you know, they're metaphorical, right? You know, but they're gospel. But generally, people try to engage the world, end up getting evangelized by the world. And we don't want to go the route of tribalism where we just huddle up. Yeah? Obviously. And so this is the issue that Ezra and Nehemiah faced. This is the issue. Is the community was being evangelized by the secular, the pagan community around them. So good to look at it from that perspective. Ezra was a priest and scribe who led the second wave of exiles from Babylon during the reign of Artaxerxes. He codified Israel's laws and probably collected and edited the Old Testament canon. It's vague, of course. There's not a lot of historical records. But most people who study this suggested it was Ezra who gathered all the Old Testament books and sort of formed the canon in the current state that it's in. And possibly was a redactor who edited some of it and put it in its final form. One of my favorite Old Testament verses about Ezra, he devoted himself to the study of the law of the Lord, to do it and to teach his statutes. If there's a better Old Testament picture of discipleship, I don't know where it is. To me, that's a pretty good summary. Devote yourself to God's word, do what you learn, and then teach others. That's pretty clear right there. Nehemiah was the trusted cupbearer. You know what the cupbearer had to do? Essentially, he had to test the wine. Right? Because if there was any poison in it, he's going to die first. So you obviously, it has to be a trusted position, because you could be the one who tested it and then slipped the poison in and he went down. So he heard a report of the state of Jerusalem and petitioned King Artaxerxes to return and rebuild the city. He served two terms as the governor of the Judean province, rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem while battling the enemies of the Lord that tried to stop him. The prominent theme of Nehemiah is the power of one person to change a nation. Power of one person. It's a story of decisive leadership coupled with significant management skills, especially reflecting the building of the walls of feet completed in 52 days. When you look at the, when you study them as one together, not just Nehemiah or not Ezra, you see team leadership being presented. Very different leadership style. If you think among victory leaders, like who would be two victory leaders whose leadership style would be on the opposite ends of the spectrum? Who stands out? Who would you think? Pick two victory leaders whose leadership style are as diametrically opposed as possible. Who would you put together? Yeah, like among us. Who's as far apart? Like Manny and Joey, maybe. Are there two people that are even farther apart that you think, as far as leadership style?
Sonny and Pastor Ferguson.
Why?
Sonny is descriptive, Pastor Ferd is prescriptive. Charge.
Yeah. Well, let your mind roam on that. And whatever you come up with, like who's farthest apart on the spectrum, that would be like Nehemiah and Ezra. Yeah. Here's an example. How they both dealt, they both had to deal with the problem of mixed marriages. Now, when Ezra realized that they were intermarrying, you know what he did? He plucked out his hair. When Nehemiah found out, you know what he did? He plucked out their hair.
You see? No. That's Ferdy and Sonny right there.
Ferdy, I won't give his hair. You fuck somebody's hair.
Oh yeah. Yeah, you did it. Did you really?
No, I remember. Fuck someone's hair here. He's a head usher.
Oh. And he had one long hair.
He has one long hair here. So I said he was in my car anyway. That's my problem.
Well, that's funny. That's funny. The great thing that we learn is that they pooled their talents, and they made a great leadership team. They were as different as you could possibly be, and yet they found a way to work together. They pooled their talents, and did great work together. Ezra on his own could never have done what he did together. Nehemiah on his own could never have done what he did. The role in redemption history, these books record the last historical events of the Old Testament. Last historical events of the Old Testament provide the background for the ministry of Malachi and set the stage for the New Testament. Intercanonical themes that we see clearly is, first of all, kingdom is the first one. Ezra and Nehemiah reveals the providential intervention of God, of the God of heaven, on behalf of his people. He's the sovereign Lord of history and will use pagan rulers, Cyrus, Darius, Artaxerxes, Trump. To accomplish his purpose. I have no idea what it is. Worship and idolatry also. Ezra and Nehemiah was written to remind the people, worship and idolatry, of God's faithfulness to restore the people to the land and to encourage the remnant to put away impurity and walk in covenantal obedience. When we read Ezra and Nehemiah and what they did to safeguard the community, it's pretty harsh. And the people who actually had married foreign wives, they killed them. You know? But in the light of history, it turns out to be necessary. All right, Esther. We may finish the Old Testament. I think we started 2.5 years ago, didn't we? Wow. And well, we're not to the New Testament yet. We still got that to do. Esther in redemption history. The story of Esther takes place in the half-century interval. I'm just trying to help you. Interval. If you lose track, you can just look right on my notes. Yeah, yeah. It's 24-point font. You should be able to read it. Between when Ezra 6 ends and then Ezra 7 starts up, over 50 years have elapsed. There's a 50-year gap between the end of chapter 6 and the beginning of chapter 7. And the story of Esther takes place during that gap in Ezra, during the reign of the Persian king Xerxes. Now, there's no clear agreement on who the author of Esther was or when it was written, but probably shortly after the death of Xerxes. When you read the text, the king Xerxes is referred to by another name, Ahasuerus, in the text. Okay, but it's really Xerxes, okay? The book of Esther is unique in that there's no mention of God, the law, or sacrifices and offerings. None of the New Testament authors ever quote from it, and no copies of it have ever been found with the Dead Sea Scrolls. Yeah, it's pretty unique. It's been controversial since the beginning. Always been a controversial book. Their reactions to it are not neutral. Some it ranged from ecstatic delight over the Jews' victory to violent dislike and rejection of it, because what looks like indefensible moral conduct, because, you know, at the end of the story, yeah, they wipe them out. I mean, they're just killed, you know. There's no reference. God's name is never even mentioned in the whole history of the book. Yeah. I don't know that. In the Hebrew canon, it's not the last book. Second or Chronicles is the last book in the Hebrew canon. So I don't know. Yeah. Do you have some information that it is? Yeah. I don't know. It's really not a theological work at all. It's an entertaining historical narrative. Have you ever preached from the book? Have we ever used the book? Yeah, it's hard to do anything much more than one sermon, you know, on it. It's kind of just like a one sermon message. When you break it down, yeah, that's a point, but that you really almost have to know the whole story to make it fit. So, chapter 4. Yeah, it's a good moralistic text for fasting, sure. But, you know, when you're doing fasting, you probably need some good moralism. Only book in the Old Testament in which the entire narrative takes place in Persia, outside of the Holy Lands. Yeah, so very unique. There is one other book in the Old Testament that doesn't mention God. God's name isn't in there. Do you know what that is?
Solomon.
Yeah, the Song of Songs, Song of Solomon. When, let's put it into redemption history, when Cyrus the Great conquered Babylon in 539 BC, he provided for the Jews to return to their land. However, the vast majority did not go. The people who did not return were in rebellion against the prophetic word from Isaiah and Jeremiah. I've given you the reference there, but prior to Cyrus, Isaiah and then Jeremiah both prophesied when the 70-year period ended, you were to come back to the land. Now, the vast percentage of the people disobeyed that prophetic word. The primary reason why is because they had prospered in Babylon. They prospered. They made money. And they didn't want to give up their money. And so the real motivation was finances. Which turns out to be a pretty important motivation all throughout Scripture. It's interesting when you look at the persecution in the book of Acts. In most cases, the primary reason behind it is finances. Yeah, the money's being... People won't generally mind about the gospel coming in, but if it starts to cut into their income, then all of a sudden...
Could it be, Paul, that because of the sovereignty of God, they stayed, yes, economy, whatever, but they stayed, and then could it be that they're the ones who influence the future Magi who eventually went?
Yeah.
Well,
I think in my particular view is that God even uses disobedience to accomplish his purposes. But, of course, this doesn't justify the disobedience. So we have two witnesses, both Isaiah and Jeremiah, two witnesses that prophesied to go out of Babylon. And so clearly the ones who didn't, they were in sin, and they will pay the penalty for that sin. The real ultimate sin is it came down to cash money. They had prospered. It's a fascinating thing. Wherever the Jews have gone in history, they've always prospered. Always prospered. My favorite historian, Paul Johnson, wrote a book called The History of the Jews. And it's a fascinating history. And there's no people group in history that have been treated more badly, have been more persecuted. And yet there's no people group that have prospered more where they go. Often the persecution comes because they out-prospered the natives there. The history of the Jews in England is the Jews prosper, the people get jealous, and then the kings force them to evacuate and leave all their property. And most of them, they were money lenders, so people that owed them money, their debts are forgiven. And the Jews lose their money, lose everything. They go somewhere else. In a matter of time,
they're back.
They're back. Yeah, you can't put them down. When you look at a list, and I saw this list of entertainers, Hollywood entertainers, that are Jewish, the vast percentage of Hollywood, you'd just be amazed. The people who not only are the actors, but of course the people who really make the money is the studio owners. Yeah. I saw a report, this was years ago, they had done a massive study of IQ among a vast selection of ethnicities, and Jews by far had the highest IQ. Matter of fact, in the study group, the average IQ was 130. Now, if you understand how IQ works, 100 is the mean, right? So it's the top of the bell curve, right? And so, and then it goes in every 15 is another major. So it's not 100. It's a, what do they call that term? Yeah. And so the difference between 100 and 115 is not the same as the difference between 130 and 115. Right? It keeps going up exponentially. Is that the term? Yeah. And so generally people mark the genius category is somewhere between 135 and 140. So the average Jewish IQ is just below the genius level. Yeah, fascinating, isn't it? You know, I'm a covenantalist. I'm not a dispensationalist. And yet it seems like God's got his hand on that people group. And there's something unique about them, right? Obviously, he has, yeah. Yeah, so. Okay, so most of them don't go. They stay in Babylon. And that's... And so it's important to recognize that this story takes place in the context of people who are in rebellion to God's purpose. So they are disobedient. And yet you see what God does. But remember the context. These are disobedient people who are outside of God's clear will for them. They should be back in the Holy Land, but they're not. And yet God still comes through. The basic details, 486 BC, and we have historic records that are outside of the text that confirms the historical document of Esther. 486, Xerxes the Great became ruler over Babylon. 3 years later, and we have corroborating evidence outside of the text, he began a preparation for an invasion of Greece. And to do that, he gave a great feast that lasts 180 days. Now, here's an interesting thing. He announces to Greece, I'm coming to get you. And I'm going to give you plenty of time to get ready. And in the meantime, what I'm going to do is we're just going to eat, drink, and have a big party. What is that meant to do? That's meant to intimidate his enemies. Yeah. I don't even have to sneak up on you. I'm going to tell you when I'm coming. Go ahead and prepare all you want. We're just going to have a party while we're waiting. That's meant to terrify. And so he has this massive party, 180 days. At the end of it, there's a special 7-day, right, to top off the banquet. And the author gives us a description. Every single drinking vessel is made out of gold, and each one is individually handcrafted. I mean, what he's doing is just showing off. To show, here's how much power I have. And Greece, if you think you had got anything to stop me, you're just a fool. And you'd be better off just to yield right now. The story continues. His queen, Vashti, refuses command to appear before his guests. This is when women's liberation begins, right here.
That's why they put it in the Bible.
I guess they did. She was removed from her position and replaced by the beautiful Jewish girl named Esther. So Esther's taken against her will, and through this amazing series of events, she's chosen to be the new queen. Esther's relative Mordecai overheard two officials plotting the murder of Xerxes. The officials were reported hanged, and the events recorded in the king's annals, although Mordecai is not commended. Now, again, that's going to come up later on. Xerxes promoted Haman to the highest position in the kingdom. When Mordecai refused to bow before him, Haman determined to destroy every Jew in the kingdom. Now, this is fascinating. To this day, during the Feast of Purim, which celebrates the events, the story is read in Jewish synagogues. And every time in the text the name of Haman is mentioned, the people in the congregation, they stamp the floor as loud as they can, and they shout out, "Let his name be blotted out." And they make this massive amount of noise. And then the story continues, and they calm down. We don't know exactly, but the amount of money that Haman offered the king is probably somewhere around the equivalent of 50 to 100 million U.S. dollars. 50 to 100 million U.S. dollars. That's what the Godfather called an offer he couldn't refuse. He said, "I'll take it." And so the king agrees, and how do they determine the day? Do you remember from the narrative? How do they determine what day he's going to kill the Jews? How do they determine the day? They draw lots. Because the lot belongs to the Lord. Yeah. There's a situation, Xerxes can't sleep, remember? He's got divine insomnia. Sometimes insomnia is from the Lord. And so to fall asleep, he decides, "Bring me the annals and let me just read through them." Sometimes people like to read when they can't sleep. And so he's reading and he comes across the incident when Mordecai saved his life. And he wasn't rewarded. So the next day he asked Haman, "What should be done for the person that the king wants to honor?" And Haman thinks it's him. And of course, he comes up with this idea. Haman's got to carry it out. And now he just hates Mordecai even more. At a banquet with Xerxes and Haman, Esther revealed to Xerxes Haman's plot to kill all the Jews. Xerxes, livid with rage, excused himself to think. Haman appealed desperately to Esther to save his life, but stumbled over Esther at the exact time Xerxes returned. It sure does. Even those accidental falls, he tripped at the exact moment. Xerxes assumed Haman was trying to molest his queen and ordered him to be hanged on the gallows that was built for Mordecai. Mordecai is exalted and the Jews are saved. What's our intercanonical themes here? The kingdom, obviously. Kingdom. The primary theme in Esther is the providence of God. Although God is never mentioned in the book, he appears on every page. God's providence is seen in Vashti's removal, Esther's promotion, Xerxes' restless night, Haman's pride in the miraculous deliverance of the Jews. This is not an accident, but a deliberative narrative technique employed by the author. The message conveyed is even when God is not speaking, he is still working. You know, that's such a powerful pastoral message that we can give our congregation. Even when God's not speaking, I can't hear his voice. He didn't speak one time in the book of Esther. No mention of prayer, no divine intervention, but he's still at work, even when he's not speaking. That brings great comfort to me. God's completely silent in Esther. He never speaks. One commentator said, though, he's standing somewhere in the shadows. He's still the central character in the drama, although he never shows up and he never speaks. Now, we compare this, you know, there's other times when the Jews were in trouble and needed deliverance. God works noticeable miracles. So the Exodus, right? The Red Sea parting. But in this story, his intervention is a lot more subtle. When God parts the Red Sea, it's pretty clear he's working miracles on your behalf. But when Xerxes gets drunk and brags about the beauty of his wife, it's a lot harder to see God at work. But both events are his providence. R.K. Harrison, the book of Esther, then, serves the purpose of showing how divine providence overrules all things. Even in a distant, far country, God's people are yet in his hands. You know, the amazing thing is, even while they're in rebellion, God's still working on their behalf and still involved in accomplishing his kingdom purposes. Thoughts about that? Any comments about Esther? Boy, I should probably finish here. But you know, I just can't. I got a really sore throat, and I got to go 3 more hours this afternoon. So can we break here? And sometime, I'm not back till November, but November will carry on, right? I'm doing the New Testament a little different, because in the New Testament, we've already done a New Testament survey. So what I'm doing when we get to the New Testament is I'm going to take our 11 themes that we've been looking at, and I'm going to go theme by theme, and I'm going to break down the Gospels, the Synoptics, the Johannine writing, the Epistles, and I'm going to show how those themes are played out in each one of the major sections of the New Testament. So we won't have an in-depth study of each book. We'll just see how the themes find their fulfillment in the New Covenant. So that's what we're working on. That's what we'll get to when we come back.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, guys.